that these findings could be explained by the existence of a ghost population, the ancient North Eurasians, who were distributed across northern Eurasia more than 15,000 years ago, and who contributed both to the population that migrated across the Bering land bridge to people of the Americas and to northern Europeans. A year later, Eska Vilerslev and colleagues obtained a sample of ancient DNA from Siberia that matched the predicted ancient North Eurasians, the Malta individual, whose skeleton dated to around 24,000 years ago. How could the finding of an ancient North Eurasian contribute to present-day Northern Europeans be reconciled with the two-way mixture of indigenous European hunter-gatherers and incoming farmers from Anatolia that had been directly demonstrated through ancient DNA studies? The plot became even thicker as we and others obtained additional ancient DNA data from hunter-gatherers and farmers between 8,000 and 5,000 years ago, and found that they fit the two-way mixture model without any evidence of ancient North Eurasian ancestry. Something profound must have happened later. A new stream of migrants must have arrived, introducing ancient North Eurasian ancestry and transforming Europe. In 2014-15, the ancient DNA community, and especially my own laboratory, published data from more than 200 ancient Europeans from Germany, Spain, Hungary, the steppe of far eastern Europe, and the first farmers from Anatolia. By comparing the ancient individuals to West Eurasian people living today, Yusif Lazaridis, in my laboratory, was able to figure out how it was that the ancient North Eurasian ancestry entered Europe within the last 5,000 years. Our initial approach was to carry out a principal component analysis, which can identify combinations of mutation frequencies that are most efficient at finding differences among samples. In doing this, we benefited from our extraordinarily high-resolution data from around 600,000 variable locations on the genome, around 10,000 times more locations than Cavalli-Sforza had been able to analyze in his 1994 book. While Cavalli-Sforza had tried to make sense of the principal component summaries of genetic variation by plotting their values onto a map of the world, we could do far more. We plotted a single dot for each individual depending on where he or she fell relative to the two principal components. On the scatter plot, we obtained for close to 800 present-day West Eurasians, two parallel lines appeared, the left containing almost all Europeans and the right containing almost all Near Easterners, with a striking gap in between. By placing all the ancient samples onto the same plot, we could watch their position shift over time, and the last 8,000 years of European history unfurled before our eyes, offering a time-lapse video showing how present-day Europeans formed from populations that had little resemblance in their ancestry to most Europeans living today. First came the hunter-gatherers, who themselves were the product of a series of population transformations over the previous 35,000 years, as described in the last chapter, the most recent of which was a massive expansion of people out of southeastern Europe by around 14,000 years ago that displaced much of the previously established population. In principal component analysis, the hunter-gatherers who lived in Europe at this time fell beyond present-day Europeans along an axis measuring the difference between Europe and the Near East. This was consistent with their having contributed ancestry to present-day Europeans, but not to present-day Near Easterners. Second came the first farmers, who lived between about 8,800 and 4,500 years ago in Germany, Spain, Hungary, and Anatolia. Ancient farmers from all these places were genetically similar to present-day Sardinians, showing that a pioneer farmer population had landed in Greece, probably from Anatolia, and then spread to Iberia in the west and Germany in the north, retaining at least 90% of their DNA from that immigrant source, which meant that they mixed minimally with the hunter-gatherers they encountered along the way. Further investigation, though, showed that it was not quite so simple. We also found that farmers from the Peloponnese in southern Greece, who lived around 6,000 years ago, may have derived part of their ancestry from a different source population in Anatolia, a population that descended more from Iranian-related populations than was the case in the northwestern Anatolian farmers, who were a likely source population for the rest of Europe's farmers. The first farming in Europe was practiced in the Peloponnese and the nearby island of Crete by people who did not use pottery. This has led some archaeologists to wonder if they were from a different migration. Our ancient DNA is consistent with this idea and suggests the possibility that this population held on for thousands of years. Third, we identified a new development in farmers living between 6,000 and 4,500 years ago. In many of these later farmers, we observed a shift toward approximately 20% extra hunter-gatherer ancestry, not present in the early farmers, implying that genetic mixing between the previously established people and new arrivals had begun, albeit after a couple of thousand years' delay. How did the farming and hunter-gatherer cultures coexist? Hints come from the funnel beaker culture, which is named for decorated clay vessels in graves dated after about 6,300 years ago. The funnel beaker culture arose in a belt of land a few hundred kilometers from the Baltic Sea, which was not reached by the first wave of farmers, probably because their methods were not optimized for the heavy soils of northern Europe. Protected by the stronghold of their difficult-to-farm environment, and sustained by the fish and game resources of Baltic Europe, the northern hunter-gatherers had more than 1,000 years to adapt to the challenge of farming. They adopted domesticated animals, and later crops, from their southern neighbors, but kept many elements of their hunter-gathering ways. The people of the funnel beaker culture were among those who built megaliths, the collective burial tombs made of stone so large it would have taken dozens of people to move them. The archaeologist Colin Renfrew suggested that megalith building might be a direct reflection of this boundary between southern farmers and hunter-gatherers turned farmers, a way of laying claim to territory, of distinguishing one people and culture from others. The genetic data may bear witness to this interaction, as there was clearly a stream of new migrants into the mixed population. Between 6,000 and 5,000 years ago, most of the northern gene pool was overtaken by farmer ancestry, and it was this mixture of a modest amount of hunter-gatherer-related ancestry and a large amount of Anatolian farmer-related ancestry, in a population that retained key elements of hunter-gatherer culture, that characterized the funnel beaker potters and many other contemporary Europeans. Europe had reached a new equilibrium. The unmixed hunter-gatherers were disappearing, persisting only in isolated pockets like the islands off southern Sweden. In southeastern Europe, a settled farmer population had developed the most socially stratified societies known up until that time, and rituals that, as the archaeologist Maria Gimbutis showed, featured women in a central way, a far cry from the male-centered rituals that followed. In remote Britain, the megalith builders were hard at work on what developed into the greatest man-made monument the world had seen, the Standing Stones of Stonehenge, which became a national place of pilgrimage, as reflected by goods brought from the far corners of Britain. People like those at Stonehenge were building great temples to their gods and tombs for their dead, and could not have known that within a few hundred years, their descendants would be gone and their lands overrun. The extraordinary fact that emerges from ancient DNA is that just 5,000 years ago, the people who are now the primary ancestors of all extant northern Europeans had not yet arrived. The tide from the east. The grasslands of the steppe stretch about 8,000 kilometers from Central Europe to China. Prior to 5,000 years ago, the archaeological evidence indicates that almost no one lived far from the steppe river valleys, because in between these areas there was too little rain to support agriculture, and too few watering holes to support livestock. The European third of the steppe was a hodgepodge of local cultures, each with its own pottery style, spread thinly over the landscape in places where water could be found. All this changed with the emergence of the Yamnaya culture around 5,000 years ago, whose economy was based on sheep and cattle herding. The Yamnaya emerged from previous cultures of the steppe and its periphery, and exploited the steppe resources far more effectively than their predecessors. They spread over a vast region from Hungary in Europe to the foothills of the Altai Mountains in Central Asia, and in many places replaced the disparate cultures that had preceded them with a more homogeneous way of life. One of the inventions that drove the spread of the Yamnaya was the wheel, whose geographic origin is not known because once it appeared, at least a few hundred years before the rise of the Yamnaya, it spread across Eurasia like wildfire. Wagons using wheels may have been adopted by the Yamnaya from their neighbors to the south, the Maikop culture in the Caucasus region between the Black and Caspian Seas. For the Maikop, as for many cultures across Eurasia, the wheel was profoundly important. But for the people of the steppe, it was, if anything, even more important, as it made possible an economy and culture that were entirely new. By hitching their animals to wagons, the Yamnaya could take their water and supplies with them into the open steppe and exploit the vast lands that had previously been inaccessible. By taking advantage of another innovation, the horse, which had recently been domesticated in a more eastern part of the steppe, and which made cattle herding more efficient, as a single rider could herd many times the number of animals than could be herded by a person on foot, the Yamnaya also became vastly more productive. The profound transformation in culture that began with the Yamnaya is obvious to many archaeologists of the steppe. The increase in the intensity of the human use of the steppe lands coincided with the nearly complete disappearance of permanent settlements. Almost all the structures that the Yamnaya left behind were graves, huge mounds of earth called kurgans. Sometimes people were buried in kurgans with wagons and horses, highlighting the importance of horses to their lifestyle. The wheel and horse so profoundly altered the economy that they led to the abandonment of village life. People lived on the move, in ancient versions of mobile homes. Prior to the explosion of ancient DNA data in 2015, most archaeologists found it inconceivable that the genetic changes associated with the spread of the Yamnaya culture could be as dramatic as the archaeological changes. Even the archaeologist David Anthony, a leading proponent of the idea that the spread of Yamnaya culture was transformative in the history of Eurasia, could not bring himself to suggest that its spread was driven by mass migration. Instead, he proposed that most aspects of Yamnaya culture spread through imitation and proselytization. But the genetics showed otherwise. Our analysis of DNA from the Yamnaya, led by Yosif Lazaridis in my laboratory, showed that they harbored a combination of ancestries that did not previously exist in Central Europe. The Yamnaya were the missing ingredient, carrying exactly the type of ancestry that needed to be added to early European farmers and hunter-gatherers to produce populations with the mixture of ancestries observed in Europe today. Our ancient DNA data also allowed us to learn how the Yamnaya themselves had formed from earlier populations. From 7,000 until 5,000 years ago, we observed a steady influx into the steppe of a population whose ancestors traced their origin to the south, as it bore genetic affinity to ancient and present-day people of Armenia and Iran, eventually crystallizing in the Yamnaya, who were about a 1-to-1 ratio of ancestry from these two sources. A good guess is that the migration proceeded via the Caucasus Isthmus between the Black and Caspian Seas. Ancient DNA data produced by Wolfgang Hawk, Johannes Krauss, and their colleagues have shown that the populations of the northern Caucasus had ancestry of this type, continuing up until the time of the Maikop culture, which just preceded the Yamnaya. The evidence that people of the Maikop culture, or the people who preceded them in the Caucasus, made a genetic contribution to the Yamnaya is not surprising, in light of the cultural influence the Maikop had on the Yamnaya. Not only did the Maikop pass on to the Yamnaya their technology of carts, but they were also the first to build the kurgans that characterized the steppe cultures for thousands of years afterward. The penetration of my Kop lands by Iranian and Armenian-related ancestry from the south is also plausible, in light of studies showing that my Kop goods were heavily influenced by elements of the Uruk civilization of Mesopotamia to the south, which was poor in metal resources and engaged in trade and exchange with the north, as reflected in Uruk goods found in settlements of the northern Caucasus. Whatever cultural process allowed the people from the south to have such a demographic impact, once the Yamnia formed, their descendants expanded in all directions. How the steppe came to Central Europe. On the eve of the arrival of steppe ancestry in Central Europe, around 5,000 years ago, the genetic ancestry of the people who lived there was largely derived from the first farmers who had come into Europe from Anatolia, beginning after 9,000 years ago, with a minority contribution from the indigenous European hunter-gatherers who mixed with them. In far eastern Europe, also around 5,000 years ago, the genetic structure of the Yamnia reflected a different mixture of ancestries, an Iranian-related population, along with an Eastern European hunter-gatherer population, in approximately equal proportions. Populations that were mixes of European farmers and steppe groups related to the Yamnia had not yet formed. The genetic impact of steppe ancestry on Central Europe came in the form of peoples who were part of the ancient culture, known to archaeologists as the corded ware, so named after its pots decorated by the impressing of twine into soft clay. Beginning around 4,900 years ago, artifacts characteristic of the corded ware culture started spreading over a vast region, from Switzerland to European Russia. The ancient DNA data showed that beginning with the corded ware culture, individuals with ancestry similar to present-day Europeans first appeared in Europe. Nick Patterson, Yosef Lazaridis, and I developed new statistical methods that allowed us to estimate that in Germany, people buried with corded ware pots derive about three-quarters of their ancestry from groups related to the Yamnia, and the rest from people related to the farmers who had been the previous inhabitants of that region. Steppe ancestry has endured, as we also found it in all subsequent archaeological cultures of Northern Europe, as well as in all present-day Northern Europeans. The genetic data thus settled a long-standing debate in archaeology about linkages between the corded ware and the Yamnia cultures. The two had many striking parallels, such as the construction of large burial mounds, the intensive exploitation of horses and herding, and a strikingly male-centered culture that celebrated violence, as reflected in the great maces, or hammer axes, buried in some graves. At the same time, there were profound differences between the two cultures, notably the entirely different types of pottery that they made, with important elements of the corded ware style adapted from previous Central European pottery styles. But the genetics showed that the connection between the corded ware culture and the Yamnia culture reflected major movements of people. The makers of the corded ware culture were, at least in a genetic sense, a westward extension of the Yamnia. The discovery that the corded ware culture reflected a mass migration of people into Central Europe from the steppe was not just a sterile academic finding. It had political and historical resonance. At the beginning of the 20th century, the German archaeologist Gustav Kasena was among the first to articulate the idea that cultures of the past that were spread across large geographic regions could be recognized through similarities in style of the artifacts they left behind. He also went further in viewing archaeologically identified cultures as synonymous with peoples, and he originated the idea that the spread of material culture could be used to trace ancient migrations, an approach he called the Siedlungsarchäologische Methode, or settlement archaeology. Based on the overlap of the geographic distribution of the corded ware culture with the places where German is spoken, Kasena suggested that the cultural roots of the Germans and of Germanic languages today lay in the corded ware culture. In his essay, The Borderland of Eastern Germany, home territory of the Germans. He argued that because the corded ware culture included the territories of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Western Russia of his day, it gave Germans the moral birthright to claim those regions as their own. Kasina's ideas were embraced by the Nazis, and although he died in 1931 before they came to power, his scholarship was used as a basis for their propaganda and a justification for their claims to territories to the east. Kasina's suggestion that migration was the primary explanation for changes in the archaeological record was also attractive to the Nazis, because it played into their racist worldview, as it was easy to imagine that migrations had been propelled by innate biological superiority of some peoples over others. Following the Second World War, European archaeologists, reacting to the politicization of their field, began picking apart the arguments of Kasina and his colleagues, documenting cases in which changes in material culture were brought about through local invention, or imitation, and not the spread of people. They urged extreme caution about invoking migration to explain changes in the archaeological record. Today, a common view among archaeologists is that migrations are only one of many explanations for past cultural change. Many archaeologists still argue that when there is evidence for major cultural change at a site, the working assumption should be that the changes reflect communication of ideas or local invention, not necessarily movements of people. Discussions of the corded ware culture and migration in the same breath ring particularly loud alarm bells because of Kasina's and the Nazis' attempt to use the corded ware culture to construct a basis for national German identity. While we were in the final stages of preparing a paper for submission in 2015, one of the German archaeologists who contributed skeletal samples wrote a letter to all co-authors. "We must, avoid being compared with the so-called Siedlungsarchäologische Methode from Gustav Kasina." He and several contributors then resigned as authors, before we modified our paper to highlight differences between Kasina's thesis and our findings, namely that the corded ware culture came from the east and that the people associated with it had not been previously established in Central Europe. The correct theory that the corded ware culture spread through a migration from the east had already been proposed in the 1920s by Kasina's contemporary, the archaeologist V. Gordon Child, although this idea, too, fell out of favor in the wake of the Second World War and the reaction to the abuse of archaeology by the Nazis, a reaction that took the form of extreme skepticism about any claims of migration. Our finding about the genetic link between the Yamnaya and the corded ware culture demonstrates the disruptive power of ancient DNA. It can prove past movements of people, and in this case has documented a magnitude of population replacement that no modern archaeologist, even the most ardent supporter of migrations, had dared to propose. The association between steppe genetic ancestry and people assigned to the corded ware archaeological culture through graves and artifacts is not simply a hypothesis. It is now a proven fact. How was it that the low population density shepherds from the steppe were able to displace the densely settled farmers of Central and Western Europe? The archaeologist Peter Bellwood has argued that once densely settled farming populations were established in Europe, it would have been practically impossible for other groups coming in to make a demographic dent, as their numbers would, he thought, have been dwarfed by the already established population. As an analogy, consider the effect of the British or Mughal occupations of India. Both powers controlled the subcontinent for hundreds of years, but left little trace in the people there today. But ancient DNA shows definitively that major population replacement happened in Europe after around 4,500 years ago. How were people with steppe ancestry able to have such an impact on an already settled region? A possible answer is that the farmers who preceded them may not have occupied every available economic niche in Central Europe, giving the steppe peoples an opportunity to expand. Although it is difficult to estimate population sizes from archaeological evidence, the number of people in Northern Europe before 2,000 years ago has been estimated to be around 100 times less than today, or even smaller, reflecting less efficient farming methods, lack of access to pesticides and fertilizers, the absence of high-yielding plant varieties, and higher infant mortality. When the corded ware culture arrived, many tilled fields in Central Europe were surrounded by virgin forests. But studies of pollen records in Denmark and elsewhere show that around this time, large parts of Northern Europe were transformed from partial forest to grasslands, suggesting that the corded ware newcomers may have cut down forests, re-engineered parts of the landscape to be more like the steppe, and carved out a niche for themselves that previous peoples of the region had never fully claimed. There is also a second possible explanation for why the steppe peoples were able to become established in Europe, one that no one would have thought plausible without ancient DNA. Eska Villeslev and Simon Rasmussen, working with the archaeologist Christian Christensen, had the idea of testing 101 ancient DNA samples from Europe and the steppe for evidence of pathogens. In 7 samples, they found DNA from Yersinia pestis, the bacterium responsible for the Black Death, estimated to have wiped out around 1/3 of the populations of Europe, India, and China around 700 years ago. Traces of plague in a person's teeth are almost a sure sign that he or she died of it. The earliest bacterial genomes that they sequenced lacked a few key genes necessary for the disease to spread via fleas, which is necessary to cause bubonic plague. But the bacterial genomes did carry the genes necessary to cause pneumonic plague, which is spread by sneezing and coughing just like the flu. That a substantial fraction of random graves analyzed carried Y. pestis shows that this disease was endemic on the steppe. Is it possible that the steppe people had picked up the plague and built up an immunity to it, and then transmitted it to the immunologically susceptible Central European farmers, causing their numbers to collapse, and thereby clearing the way for the corded ware culture expansion? This would be a great irony. One of the most important reasons for the collapse of Native American populations after 1492 was infectious diseases spread by Europeans, who plausibly had built up some immunity to these diseases after thousands of years of exposure, as a result of living in close proximity to their farm animals. But Native Americans, who by and large lacked domesticated animals, likely had much less resistance to them. Was it possible that, in a similar way, Northern European farmers, after 5,000 years ago, were decimated by plagues brought from the East, paving the way for the spread of steppe ancestry through Europe? How Britain succumbed. After the wave of steppe ancestry crashed over Central Europe, it kept rolling. Beginning around 4,700 years ago, a couple of centuries after the corded ware culture swept into Central Europe, there was an equally dramatic expansion of the Bell Beaker culture, probably from the region of present-day Iberia. The Bell Beaker culture is named for its bell-shaped drinking vessels that rapidly spread over a vast expanse of Western Europe, alongside other artifacts, including decorative buttons and archers' wrist guards. It is possible to learn about the movement of people and objects by studying the ratios of isotopes of elements like strontium, lead, and oxygen that are characteristic of materials in different parts of the world. By studying the isotopic composition of teeth, archaeologists have shown that some people of the Bell Beaker culture moved hundreds of kilometers from their places of birth. Bell Beaker culture spread to Britain after 4,500 years ago. A major open question for understanding the spread of the Bell Beaker culture has always been whether it was propelled by the movement of people or the spread of ideas. At the beginning of the 20th century, the recognition of the massive impact of the Bell Beaker culture led to the romantic notion of a beaker folk, a people who disseminated a new culture, and perhaps Celtic languages, a nod to the nationalistic fervor of the time. But like the claim made for the corded ware culture, this position fell out of favor after the Second World War. In 2017, my laboratory succeeded in assembling whole genome ancient DNA data from more than 200 skeletons associated with the beaker culture from across Europe. Inigo Olalde, a postdoctoral scientist, analyzed the data to show that individuals in Iberia were genetically indistinguishable from the people who had preceded them, and who were not buried in a bell beaker culture style. But bell beaker-associated individuals in Central Europe were extremely different, with most of their ancestry of steppe origin, and little, if any, ancestry in common with individuals from Iberia associated with the bell beaker culture. So in contrast to what happened with the spread of the corded ware culture from the East, the initial spread of the bell beaker culture across Europe was mediated by the movement of ideas, not by migration. Once the bell beaker culture reached Central Europe through the dispersal of ideas, though, it spread further through migration. Prior to the spread of beaker culture into Britain, not a single ancient DNA sample from among the many dozen we analyzed had any steppe ancestry. But after 4,500 years ago, each one of the many dozens of ancient British samples we analyzed had large amounts of steppe ancestry, and no special affinity to Iberians at all. Measured in terms of its proportion of steppe ancestry, DNA extracted from dozens of bell beaker skeletons in Britain closely matches that of skeletons from bell beaker culture graves across the English Channel. The genetic impact of the spread of peoples from the continent into the British Isles in this period was permanent. British and Irish skeletons from the Bronze Age that followed the Beaker period had at most around 10% ancestry from the first farmers of these islands, with the other 90% from people like those associated with the Bell Beaker culture in the Netherlands. This was a population replacement at least as dramatic as the one that accompanied the spread of the corded ware culture. It turns out that the discredited idea of the Beaker folk was right for Britain, although wrong as an explanation for the spread of the bell beaker culture over the European continent as a whole. So it is that ancient DNA data are beginning to provide us with a more nuanced view of how cultures changed in prehistory. Prompted by the ancient DNA results, several archaeologists have speculated to me that the bell beaker culture could be viewed as a kind of ancient religion that converted peoples of different backgrounds to a new way of viewing the world, thus serving as an ideological solvent that facilitated the integration and spread of steppe ancestry and culture into Central and Western Europe. At a Hungarian bell beaker site, we found direct evidence that this culture was open to people of diverse ancestries, with individuals buried in a bell beaker cultural context having the full range of steppe ancestry from 0 to 75%, as high as in people associated with the corded ware culture. What made it possible for people practicing the beaker culture to spread so dramatically into northwestern Europe and outcompete the established and highly sophisticated populations previously established there? Archaeologists view the bell beaker culture as extremely different from the corded ware culture, which was in turn extremely different from the Omnia culture. Yet all three participated in the massive spread of steppe ancestry from east to west, and perhaps they shared some elements of an ideology despite their very different features. Speculations about shared features among cultures separated from each other by hundreds of kilometers make scientists and archaeologists uncomfortable. But we should pay attention. Prior to the genetic findings, any claim that a new way of seeing the world could have been shared across cultures as archaeologically different from one another as the Yamnia, corded ware, and bell beaker could confidently be dismissed as fanciful. But now we know that these people were linked by major migrations, some of which overwhelmed earlier cultures, providing evidence that these migrations had profound effects. We also need to look again at the spread of language, a direct manifestation of the spread of culture. That almost all Europeans today speak closely related languages is proof that there was strong dissemination of a new culture across Europe at one time. Could the spread of shared languages across Europe have been propelled by the spread of people documented by ancient DNA? The origin of Indo-European languages. A great mystery of prehistory is the origin of Indo-European languages, the closely related group of tongues that today are spoken across almost all of Europe, Armenia, Iran, and northern India, with a great gap in the Near East, where these languages only existed at the periphery for the last 5,000 years, a fact known to us because writing was invented there. One of the first people to note this similarity among Indo-European languages was William Jones, a judge serving in Calcutta in British India, who knew Greek and Latin from his school days, and had learned Sanskrit, the language of the ancient Indian religious texts. In 1786, he observed, "The Sanskrit language, whatever may be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong indeed that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source which, perhaps, no longer exists. For more than 200 years, scholars have puzzled over how such a similarity of languages developed over so vast a region. In 1987, Colin Renfrew proposed a unified theory for how Indo-European languages attained their current distribution. In his book, Archaeology and Language, The Puzzle of Indo-European Origins, he suggested that the homogeneity of language across such a vast stretch of Eurasia today could be explained by one and the same event: the spread from Anatolia after 9,000 years ago of peoples bringing agriculture. His argument was rooted in the idea that farming would have given Anatolians an economic advantage that would have allowed new populations to spread massively into Europe. Anthropological studies have consistently shown that major migrations of people are necessary to achieve language change in small-scale societies. So a phenomenon as profound as the spread of Indo-European languages was likely to have been propelled by mass migration. Since there was no good archaeological evidence for a later major migration into Europe, and since once densely settled farming populations were established, it was difficult to imagine how other groups could gain a foothold. Renfrew and scholars who followed him concluded that the spread of farming was probably what brought Indo-European languages to Europe. Renfrew's logic was compelling, given the data he had available at the time, but the argument that the spread of farming from Anatolia drove the spread of Indo-European languages into Europe has been undermined by the findings from studies of ancient DNA, which showed that a mass movement of people into Central Europe occurred after 5,000 years ago, in association with the corded ware culture. By arguing from first principles that after the spread of farming into Europe, it would not have been demographically plausible for there to have been another migration substantial enough to induce a language shift, Renfrew constructed a compelling case for the Anatolian hypothesis, which won many adherents. But theory is always trumped by data, and the data show that the Yamnaya also made a major demographic impact. In fact, it is clear that the single most important source of ancestry across northern Europe today is the Yamnaya or groups closely related to them. This suggests that the Yamnaya expansion likely spread a major new group of languages throughout Europe. The ubiquity of Indo-European languages in Europe over the last few thousand years, and the fact that the Yamnaya-related migration was more recent than the farming one, makes it likely that at least some Indo-European languages in Europe, and perhaps all of them, were spread by the Yamnaya. The main counter-argument to the Anatolian hypothesis is the steppe hypothesis, the idea that Indo-European languages spread from the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas. The best single argument for the steppe hypothesis, prior to the availability of genetic data, may be the one constructed by David Anthony, who has shown that the shared vocabulary of the great majority of present-day Indo-European languages is unlikely to be consistent with their having originated much earlier than about 6,000 years ago. His key observation is that all extant branches of the Indo-European language family, except for the most anciently diverging Anatolian ones that are now extinct, such as ancient Hittite, have an elaborate shared vocabulary for wagons, including words for axle, harness, pole, and wheels. Anthony interpreted this sharing as evidence that all Indo-European languages spoken today, from India in the east to the Atlantic fringe in the west, descend from a language spoken by an ancient population that used wagons. This population could not have lived much earlier than about 6,000 years ago, since we know from archaeological evidence that it was around then that wheels and wagons spread. This date rules out the Anatolian farming expansion into Europe between 9,000 and 8,000 years ago. The obvious candidate for dispersing most of today's Indo-European languages is thus the Yamnaya, who depended on the technology of wagons and wheels that became widespread around 5,000 years ago. That there could have been a massive enough migration by steppe pastoralists to displace settled agricultural populations and thereby distribute a new language seems on the face of it even more implausible for India than for Europe. India is protected from the steppe by the high mountains of Afghanistan, whereas there is no similar barrier protecting Europe. Yet the steppe pastoralists broke through to India too. As is related in the next chapter, almost everyone in India is a mixture of two highly divergent ancestral populations, one of which derived about half its ancestry directly from the Yamnaya. While the genetic findings point to a central role for the Yamnaya in spreading Indo-European languages, tipping the scales definitively in favor of some variant of the steppe hypothesis, those findings do not yet resolve the question of the homeland of the original Indo-European languages, the place where these languages were spoken before the Yamnaya so dramatically expanded. Anatolian languages, known from 4,000-year-old tablets recovered from the Hittite Empire and neighboring ancient cultures, did not share the full wagon and wheel vocabulary present in all Indo-European languages spoken today. Ancient DNA available from this time in Anatolia shows no evidence of steppe ancestry similar to that in the Yamnaya, although the evidence here is circumstantial, as no ancient DNA from the Hittites themselves has yet been published. This suggests to me that the most likely location of the population that first spoke an Indo-European language was south of the Caucasus Mountains, perhaps in present-day Iran or Armenia, because ancient DNA from people who lived there matches what we would expect for a source population both for the Yamnaya and for ancient Anatolians. If this scenario is right, the population sent one branch up into the steppe, mixing with steppe hunter-gatherers, in a one-to-one ratio to become the Yamnaya as described earlier, and another to Anatolia to found the ancestors of people there who spoke languages such as Hittite. To an outsider, it might seem surprising that DNA can have a definitive impact on a debate about language. DNA cannot, of course, reveal what languages people spoke. But what genetics can do is to establish that migrations occurred. If people moved, it means that cultural contact occurred too. In other words, genetic tracing of migrations makes it possible also to trace potential spreads of culture and language. By tracing possible migration paths and ruling out others, ancient DNA has ended a decades-old stalemate in the controversy regarding the origins of Indo-European languages. The Anatolian hypothesis has lost its best evidence, and the most common version of the steppe hypothesis, which suggests that the ultimate origin of all Indo-European languages, including ancient Anatolian languages, was in the steppe, has to be modified too. DNA has emerged as central to the new synthesis of genetics, archaeology, and linguistics that is now replacing outdated theories. A great lesson of the ancient DNA revolution is that its findings almost always provide accounts of human migrations that are very different from pre-existing models, showing how little we really knew about human migrations and population formation prior to the invention of this new technology. The vision of Indo-Europeans, or Aryans, as a pure group has sparked nationalist sentiments in Europe since the 19th century. There were debates about whether the Celts or the Teutons or other groups were the real Aryans, and Nazi racism was fueled by this discussion. The genetic data have provided what might seem like uncomfortable support for some of these ideas, suggesting that a single, genetically coherent group was responsible for spreading many Indo-European languages. But the data also reveal that these early discussions were misguided in supposing purity of ancestry. Whether the original Indo-European speakers lived in the Near East or in Eastern Europe, the Yamnaya, who were the main group responsible for spreading Indo-European languages across a vast span of the globe, were formed by mixture. The people who practiced the corded ware culture were a further mixture, and Northwestern Europeans associated with the bell beaker culture were yet a further mixture. Ancient DNA has established major migration and mixture between highly divergent populations as a key force shaping human prehistory. And ideologies that seek a return to a mythical purity are flying in the face of hard science. 6. The collision that formed India. The fall of the Indus civilization. In the oldest text of Hinduism, the Rig Veda, the warrior god Indra rides against his impure enemies, or Dasa, in a horse-drawn chariot, destroys their fortresses, or Pur, and secures land and water for his people, the Arya, or Aryans. Composed between 4,000 and 3,000 years ago in Old Sanskrit, the Rig Veda was passed down orally for some 2,000 years before being written down, much like the Iliad and Odyssey in Greece, which were composed several hundred years later in another early Indo-European language. The Rig Veda is an extraordinary window into the past, as it provides a glimpse of what Indo-European culture might have been like in a period far closer in time to when these languages radiated from a common source. But what did the stories of the Rig Veda have to do with real events? Who were the Dasa? Who were the Arya? And where were the fortresses located? Did something like this really happen? There was tremendous excitement about the possibility of using archaeology to gain insight into these questions in the 1920s and 1930s. In those years, excavations uncovered the remains of an ancient civilization, walled cities at Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, and elsewhere in the Punjab and Sindh that dated from 4,500 to 3,800 years ago. These cities and smaller towns and villages dotted the valley of the River Indus in present-day Pakistan and parts of India, and some of them sheltered tens of thousands of people. Were they perhaps the fortresses, or Pur, of the Rig Veda? Indus Valley civilization cities were surrounded by perimeter walls and laid out on grids. They had ample storage for grain supplied by farming of land in the surrounding river plains. The city sheltered craftspeople skilled in working clay, gold, copper, shell, and wood. The people of the Indus Valley civilization engaged in prolific trade and commerce, as reflected in the stone weights and measures they left behind, and their trading partners, who lived as far away as Afghanistan, Arabia, Mesopotamia, and even Africa. They made decorative seals with images of humans or animals. There were often signs or symbols on the seals whose meaning remains largely undeciphered. Since the original excavations, many things about the Indus Valley civilization have remained enigmatic, not only its script. The greatest mystery is its decline. Around 3,800 years ago, the settlements of the Indus dwindled, with population centers shifting east toward the Ganges Plain. Around this time, the Rig Veda was composed in Old Sanskrit, a language that is ancestral to the great majority of languages spoken in northern India today, and that had diverged in the millennium before the Rig Veda was composed from the languages spoken in Iran. Indo-Iranian languages are in turn cousins of almost all of the languages spoken in Europe, and with them make up the great Indo-European language family. The religion of the Rig Veda, with its pantheon of deities governing nature and regulating society, had unmistakable similarities to the mythology of other parts of Indo-European Eurasia, including Iran, Greece, and Scandinavia, providing further evidence of cultural links across vast expanses of Eurasia, Some have speculated that the collapse of the Indus Valley civilization was caused by the arrival in the region of migrants from the north and west, speaking Indo-European languages, the so-called Indo-Aryans. In the Rig Veda, the invaders had horses and chariots. We know from archaeology that the Indus Valley civilization was a pre-horse society. There is no clear evidence of horses at their sites, nor are there remains of spoke-wheeled vehicles, although there are clay figurines of wheeled carts pulled by cattle. Horses and spoke-wheeled chariots were the weapons of mass destruction of Bronze Age Eurasia. Did the Indo-Aryans use their military technology to put an end to the old Indus Valley civilization? Since the original excavations at Harappa, the Aryan invasion theory has been seized on by nationalists in both Europe and India, which makes the idea difficult to discuss in an objective way. European racists, including the Nazis, were drawn to the idea of an invasion of India, in which the dark-skinned inhabitants were subdued by light-skinned warriors, related to Northern Europeans, who imposed on them a hierarchical caste system that forbade intermarriage across groups. To the Nazis and others, the distribution of the Indo-European language family, linking Europe to India, and having little impact on the Near East with its Jews, spoke of an ancient conquest moving out of an ancestral homeland, displacing and subjugating the peoples of the conquered territories, an event that they wished to emulate. Some placed the ancestral homeland of the Indo-Aryans in Northeast Europe, including Germany. They also adopted features of Vedic mythology as their own, calling themselves Aryans after the term in the Rig Veda, and appropriating the swastika, a traditional Hindu symbol of good fortune. The Nazis' interest in migrations and the spread of Indo-European languages has made it difficult for serious scholars in Europe to discuss the possibility of migrations spreading Indo-European languages. In India, the possibility that the Indus Valley civilization fell at the hands of migrating Indo-European speakers coming from the north is also fraught, as it suggests that important elements of South Asian culture might have been influenced from the outside. The idea of a mass migration from the north has fallen out of favor among scholars, not only because it has become so politicized, but also because archaeologists have realized that major cultural shifts in the archaeological record do not always imply major migrations. And in fact, there is scant archaeological evidence for such a population movement. There are no obvious layers of ash and destruction around 3,800 years ago, suggesting the burning and sacking of the Indus towns. If anything, there is evidence that the Indus Valley civilization's decline played out over a long period, with emigration away from the towns and environmental degradation taking place over decades. But the lack of archaeological evidence does not mean that there were no major incursions from the outside. Between 1600 and 1500 years ago, the Western Roman Empire collapsed under the pressure of the German expansions, with great political and economic blows dealt to the Western Roman Empire when the Visigoths and the Vandals each sacked Rome and took political control of Roman provinces. However, there so far seems to be little archaeological evidence for destruction of Roman cities in this time, and if not for the detailed historical accounts, we might not know these pivotal events occurred. It is possible that in the apparent depopulation of the Indus Valley too, we might be limited by the difficulty archaeologists have in detecting sudden change. The patterns evident from archaeology may be obscuring more sudden triggering events. What can genetics add? It cannot tell us what happened at the end of the Indus Valley civilization, but it can tell us if there was a collision of peoples with very different ancestries. Although mixture is not by itself proof of migration, the genetic evidence of mixture proves that dramatic demographic change, and thus opportunity for cultural exchange, occurred close to the time of the fall of Harappa. A land of collisions. The Great Himalayas were formed around 10 million years ago by the collision of the Indian continental plate, moving northward through the Indian Ocean with Eurasia. India today is also the product of collisions of cultures and people. Consider farming. The Indian subcontinent is one of the breadbaskets of the world. Today it feeds a quarter of the world's population, and it has been one of the great population centers ever since modern humans expanded across Eurasia after 50,000 years ago. Yet farming was not invented in India. Indian farming today is born of the collision of the two great agricultural systems of Eurasia, the Near Eastern winter rainfall crops, wheat and barley, reached the Indus Valley sometime after 9,000 years ago, according to archaeological evidence, as attested, for example, in ancient Murugar on the western edge of the Indus Valley in present-day Pakistan. Around 5,000 years ago, local farmers succeeded in breeding these crops to adapt to monsoon summer rainfall patterns, and the crops spread into peninsular India. The Chinese monsoon summer rainfall crops of rice and millet also reached peninsular India around 5,000 years ago. India may have been the first place where the Near Eastern and the Chinese crop systems collided. Language is another blend. The Indo-European languages of the north of India are related to the languages of Iran and Europe. The Dravidian languages, spoken mostly by southern Indians, are not closely related to languages outside South Asia. There are also Sino-Tibetan languages spoken by groups living in the mountains fringing the north of India, and small pockets of tribal groups in the east and center that speak Austroasiatic languages related to Cambodian and Vietnamese, and that are thought to descend from the languages spoken by the peoples who first brought rice farming to South Asia and parts of Southeast Asia. Words borrowed from ancient Dravidian and Austroasiatic languages, which linguists can detect as they are not typical of Indo-European languages, are present in the Rig Veda, implying that these languages have been in contact in India for at least 3 or 4,000 years. The people of India are also diverse in appearance, providing visual testimony to mixture. A stroll down a street in any Indian city makes it clear how diverse Indians are. Skin shades range from dark to pale. Some people have facial features like Europeans, others closer to Chinese. It is tempting to think that these differences reflect a collision of peoples who mixed at some point in the past, with different proportions of mixture in different groups living today. But it is also possible to overinterpret physical appearances, as it is known that appearances can also reflect environment and diet. The first genetic work in India gave seemingly contradictory results. Researchers studying mitochondrial DNA, always passed down from mothers, found that the vast majority of mitochondrial DNA in Indians was unique to the subcontinent, and they estimated that the Indian mitochondrial DNA types only shared common ancestry with ones predominant outside South Asia many tens of thousands of years ago. This suggested that on the maternal line, Indian ancestors had been largely isolated within the subcontinent for a long time, without mixing with neighboring populations to the west, east, or north. In contrast, a good fraction of Y chromosomes in India, passed from father to son, showed closer relatedness to West Eurasians, Europeans, Central Asians, and Near Easterners, suggesting mixture. Some historians of India have thrown up their hands and discounted genetic information due to these apparently conflicting findings. The situation has not been helped by the fact that geneticists do not have formal training in archaeology, anthropology, and linguistics, the fields that have dominated the study of human prehistory, and are prone to make elementary mistakes or to be tripped up by known fallacies when summarizing findings from those fields. But it is foolhardy to ignore genetics. We geneticists may be the barbarians coming late to the study of the human past, but it is always a bad idea to ignore barbarians. We have access to a type of data that no one has had before, and we are wielding these data to address previously unapproachable questions about who ancient peoples were. The isolated people of Little Andaman Island. My research into the prehistory of India began in 2007 with a book and a letter. The book was The History and Geography of Human Genes, Luca Cavalli-Sforza's magnum opus, in which he mentions the Negrito, people of the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal, hundreds of kilometers from the mainland. The Andaman Islands have remained isolated by deep sea barriers.